Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. I'm your co-host, Dr. Thad Woodard. This is a very interesting program from my point of view, and it revolves a personal story that has evolved into a much more systemic issue after discovering that he had cobalt poisoning due to corrosion of a hip implant. Local orthopedic surgeon Dr. Steve Tower began to investigate how extensive this problem might be in others. And he's now reported 9 patients with cobalt poisoning, including patients with various and different types of implants. Both all have cobalt in them, however. Today, we're going to review these findings. This is the third time, I think, that we've been on the program. It's kind of an evolving story. He continues to look into these patients. And today, perhaps a little bit differently, we're going to be also emphasizing the correlation of the cobalt related problems with cognitive decline by neuropsychological testing and with some objective findings with as well with brain PET scans. Dr. Steve Tower specializes in the primary and revision of the hip, knee, and shoulder surgery, in addition to general orthopedics and trauma care. And joining him today in the studio will be Deborah Gideon. Deborah is a clinical neuropsychologist who has about 30 years of experience at Advanced Neuropsychology of Alaska. Also joining us by telephone is Dr. Bob Bridges. Bob is a radiologist and nuclear medicine specialist associated with Turnagain Radiology and the Diagnostic Health Alaska. Both Dr. Gideon and Dr. Bridges have been involved with studies studies of these patients that have been identified with neurologic symptoms associated with cobalt and have all had these hip implants. Welcome to all of you. It's nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Appreciate the opportunity.
Steve, Dr. Tower, let's start with just a brief overview of this issue of hip implants, and maybe I've already kind of given a little bit of what happened, but bring us a little bit up to date about where we are.
Yeah, in a nutshell, I actually had my hip replaced in 2006 with a type of hip that's referred to as a metal-on-metal hip. When we talk about joint replacements, hip replacements in particular, we often reference what the material of the ball is and the material of the part of the socket that the ball is rubbing on. So in my particular case, the ball was made out of chrome cobalt, which is a hard alloy used in machine applications, and attractive from an arthroprosthetic standpoint because it is such a hard material. And it's been used for many years, greater than 20 years, in joint replacement. What was different in my case and made my hip particularly prone to problems was it was rubbing on a chrome cobalt insert in the socket. So it was actually chrome cobalt rubbing on chrome cobalt. This was thought to perhaps have advantages compared to what had been more commonly used, which was a chrome cobalt ball rubbing on a plastic socket insert. What we found, and I had my hip when the metal-on-metals were peaking in popularity. They, at this time, about 1 in 3 hip replacements done in the United States used the metal-on-metal technology. What happened in my case, there were specific design issues to my particular hip, which has since actually been formally recalled from the market, perhaps in part due to my experience with it. The joint developed, generated a very large amount of metal debris from wear of the ball and wear of the socket. And this hadn't really been reported to be a problem. And as an orthopedic surgeon with a research interest in design and materials, I was very curious when about a year after my replaced hip, the hip became painful. Because that's not my usual experience as a surgeon who's put in nearly 1,000 of these. Usually the hips are pain-free and remain pain-free. I became curious what might be doing that, so I actually started checking the levels of cobalt in my blood and found them to be much, much higher than anybody expected they should be. And I followed that along for a period of time, and about a year and a half, 2 years, also started to develop some new medical problems, which both were neurologically based and affected my heart. And since I was aware that I had elevated levels of blood cobalt, I could put a lot of time and research into that. And still, my experience seemed to be somewhat unique. Nobody else was really talking about this. And when I would talk to the manufacturers and the surgeons who designed my particular hip, they weren't aware of anybody else having these problems. And then at about just over 3 years after the hip was replaced, the hip became so painful that it required revision surgery. And at that time, a remarkable amount of tissue damage around the hip was found. And also, within a short period of time, the neurologic issues that I had experienced went away. And I found that to be interesting because it all correlated with the rise and fall in my blood cobalt levels. And I had placed the same hip in one of my patients. A patient had similar problems, and he developed progressive pain at the hip, so he underwent revision surgery as well, and his problems resolved. And based on my experience and that of my patients, I actually wrote up a case report or case series that was published in our most prestigious orthopedic journal in the United States, reporting the potential for the metal-on-metal hips to actually make people sick in a neurologic or cardiac sense. And that was the first time that this had been reported. And it was kind of dismissed by, I guess you might call the establishment, as maybe being a very rare occurrence. And that report got published in late 2010. And what has happened as time has passed, more and more cases have been reported. And I've also become very sensitive to the issue within my own practice. And I've identified progressively more cases in the patients that received the metal-on-metal hips. A more recent development has been that we're also now seeing similar problems in patients that have metal-on-plastic hips, which were not previously thought to be at risk for the cobalt-related problems. And in those patients, the elevated levels of cobalt are coming from corrosion at the junctions where a chrome cobalt head generally is attached to generally a titanium alloy stem that's fixed within the femur.
One thing I would like our listeners to be aware of, let me put it this way. I've decided that we would not take phone calls today. We will take your emails. You can email questions at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at alaskapublic.org. And we will forward those questions, particularly if they're not used on the air, to Dr. Tower to respond, because we expect a number of people may have some specific concerns. What we want to do today is just get the information out there, try to put some perspective on it. And I apologize for not letting people know in advance and not saying this earlier in the program. So we will not be accepting phone calls. You can email questions at lineonealaskapublic.org, and we'll do our best to get those questions answered for you, if not on the air, by Dr. Tower specifically. So how do implants and heart equipment get vetted to be used? Medications have to go through an FDA safety and efficacy. They have to be proven both safe and effective. How about implants, hip implants, or hard materials that are used in humans for treatment?
Of the hips that are being commonly implanted in the United States today, less than 1% have gone through the same process at the FDA that a new drug would have to go through. And that's termed a pre-market approval process, which involves that the drug has to be studied to the point of human clinical trials, just to prove what Dr. Woodard said, that it needs to be safe and it needs to be effective. Most, 99% of the HIPs presently put into Americans were approved through an abbreviated process called a 510K, where the only prerequisite for approval is the devices substantially resemble a device that either had undergone pre-market approval or resembled a device that was in use before the pre-market approval process became established. And this has allowed for an evolution of HIP devices where there's been so many changes made to materials and designs that they may not resemble the predicate device, which was kind of the grandfather. And there was actually a very good review of this in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed this process of multiple changes resulting in devices that didn't really were much different than the predicate devices. In particular, as far as this class of joints called the metal-on-metal hip replacement, the predicate device was one that was used in the 1970s and really wasn't used at all after 1980. Yet, since that device had been in use before more rigorous regulation, it was approved for use. And the metal-on-metals have fared so poorly that several, only one, the particular HIP I had, has been formally recalled from the market. But otherwise, they have they're no longer available. It's what I would call a silent recall. Unfortunately, as far as those patients are at risk for problems because they have a metal-on-metal hip, very few will have been notified that there's a problem with that particular design, those being the patients that had my particular hip that were actually received some form of notification that they had a formally recalled device.
You published a paper where you looked at the world's literature of reported of these of situations like this. Your situation was pretty dramatic. You had significant neurologic problems. You had some cardiac involvement. You had cobalt levels that were high. You had your hip replaced, and your symptoms went away, and your cobalt level went down. Is your feeling that because, well, there's only, like I said, you when you reviewed, maybe you found 25 cases. So this is like the tip of the iceberg. These are the more severe cases that have come to report?
Yeah, I would say that's absolutely true. You don't, in order to get published as a case report, by definition, it's an extreme case. And in that review of the literature, my particular case was one of the milder ones reported. The majority of the patients had higher blood cobalts than I had. And the more severe cases, there was one fatality from multi-organ failure and heart failure. But most of the patients had significant blindness, significant deafness, and significant peripheral neuropathy. They had numb hands and feet, some of them to the point where they were so weak and insensate that they were wheelchair bound.
All right, I want to bring in our other guests. So let's, Bob, Dr. Bridges, let me bring you in and ask how you got involved in the process and what you've done with scanning and what your findings have been on the patients you've looked at.
Initially, the introduction to this problem, with the discussion with Dr. Tower, some of the complications locally for hip replacement, and there are these inflammatory tumor-like growths that can develop around the hip area, around the prosthetic cobalt head. And in our discussion, he went into to describe the neurological findings that these people were having. And with a history of experience in brain imaging, it became interesting to me that maybe we were dealing with something that we could not only quantify, potentially even intercede in earlier over the toxicity that was found in the literature. And when we look at brain imaging, we've got two pathways we can look at it in modern imaging. We've got the anatomic information, or we can go the route of metabolic information. And anatomic information, people are familiar with the X-ray CT scan and the MRI scan of the brain, which we use powerful magnets and radio waves to generate images of the interior of the body, particularly the brain. The problem with both these anatomic pathways is that so often very sensitive changes will not be evident. Large tumors, maybe large areas of infarct, the masses we'll see, but subtle metabolic changes won't be. When we look at the metabolic information that's available from imaging these days, we have the ability to look and see how the brain actually is functioning at a metabolic level. And we do that either by imaging agents which look at flow, or in the case of PET imaging, we can directly look at the metabolism of the brain and see whether there's areas of abnormality or not. The brain basically functions solely on the sugar glucose molecule. No other type of sugars involved or fatty acids. Fortunately, the main workhorse for PET imaging or positron emission tomography is glucose, in which we take the glucose and we substitute in a fluorine 18 atom into the glucose. It's close enough to what the body sees as regular glucose to be at least brought into the cell and around the body. We can use it to assess for malignancy, we can also, and for the heart condition, but also we can do it for the brain. So we have this isotope we can then put onto the glucose, and as the brain's metabolism, we will see it proportional lighting up in the brain, and we can actually create a mapping, much like an MRI scan or a CT, of cross-sectional information to see what's going on. Important, too, is that PET imaging is quantitative, and we have the ability to match these patients with an atlas of known normals for age and sex of the patients. So we can actually gauge the patient's metabolic activity in the brain versus that of the normals that will be we can use as an atlas. The sensitivity is really impressive because clinically, like with Alzheimer's and these other dementias, PET brain imaging will detect abnormalities 2 years before they become clinically evident on physical examination. And so that was why it was interesting to me, was the fact is maybe we can see what's happening earlier, gauge what's happening now with the toxicity, see what happens if when the therapy it can be either a removal of the offending cobalt device or maybe chelation, but also see if we can see earlier on to see when we begin to see these people having abnormalities in their metabolic function. So we're comparing the metabolic activity with the neurological findings seen by neurologists and trying to get a cohesive assessment and quantitative evaluation between these different specialties to provide a more complete answer to what's going on in the person's brain at an earlier time.
So what happens, let me just take just a second, is if there is a dementia or some problem, then the metabolic uptake and use of glucose is decreased. That affects the scan, which can then be quantified and correlates with function. There's several points there I was making. Is that true?
Correct. In fact, the classic dementias of Alzheimer's, Lewy bodies, and Fick's disease actually have a classic pattern on PET imaging. And so not only is there a quantitative information, but we get a classic presentation on looking at the brain imaging. And we can project what the brain looks like with colored imaging of the brain and see these patterns. And so we were looking forward to seeing, with this an early portion of the examination, do we have a similar pattern or a different pattern that might be pathognomonic for what's going on with this cobalt poisoning?
Pathognomonic meaning very, very specific for that particular problem.
Correct.
Okay.
So we've had the early look at these patients, and we've come up with a rather interesting pattern, and it's different from every other dementia going on. And we're beginning to now quantify individual areas of the brain to assess their function and the abnormalities. So, again, at an early stage, but we are very encouraged that we're finding some abnormalities, which may be a fingerprint, which will allow easier recognition by physicians looking at patients with this cobalt toxicity.
So the questions I would have if as a listener, so we know that PET scans are very good at picking up dementias, so they're sensitive. The question that still remains in my mind is the specificity, because a lot of these patients that are having hip implants may already have age-related cognitive problems. So how specific are the findings? Is that, were you saying that they're very specific for this unique kind of problem?
So far, yes. As we're looking at a predominantly older generation, there are degenerative changes going on in the brain, but they have a more general pattern and can be anticipated. And this is an entirely different pattern we're seeing right now. Again, we'll have to look at the data more closely to see if this pans out. But people ask the question, if with older individuals, of course they would have changes because of age, but or because of vascular disease or stroke. But we have the ability with the PET CT scan to take a look at the CT side to see what's happening in the brain. We can also do MRI scans and fuse them with the PET imaging for correlation. So we have ways to assess and better categorize what areas are involved and what's causing those abnormalities. And it's important, too, because if you're diagnosed with a dementia, you're pretty much in a closed loop. You're not going to get a lot of additional work done on you. And a lot of these people that have had this, and part of the symptoms include Parkinson's symptoms in younger individuals. And you have these people who could potentially be given the misdiagnosis of a dementia, a permanent dementia, like Alzheimer's. Well, actually, it is a reversible dementia because of the toxicity from the cobalt. So going forward, we're looking at not only diagnosing, but also preventing people from being misdiagnosed into diseases which they don't have, but would be considered permanent, and limit their medical care and attention.
How about evidence of anyone looking at PET scans in cobalt-related problems in the past? Is this new, or is this compatible, what you're finding with other reports?
I've looked at the literature, and there's no literature on cobalt poisoning with PET imaging. This is entirely new territory.
Wow. That's somewhat because of the newer technology of PET scans, do you think?
That also awareness of the problems. The technology has been around for some time, but PET has only become a clinical tool in the community environment in the last 15 years. So yes, in a clinical environment, away from the university, away from research. It has been about a 15-year history of being in a mainstream clinical environment. In Alaska, PET imaging started in 2003. So we've had essentially 13 years of experience in PET imaging up in Alaska. So it is new in many respects to apply it at a community level with community disease processes versus the academic environment.
All right. Let me remind listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. I have taken the liberty today to ask that we not take phone calls. I know there are listeners who have questions, and if you have questions, I'm going to ask you to email them to us at Line 1, LINEONE, at alaskapublic.org. Once we get those emails, we'll either address them on the air, or Dr. Tower will get in touch with you after the program to answer any questions you have. We are also roughly halfway through the program right now, so I'm going to take a short one-minute break that we often do, and then we'll continue our discussion on cobalt poisoning and hip implants and with our guests today, Dr. Steve Tower, Dr. Deborah Gideon, and Dr. Bob Bridges. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Thank you. You're listening to Line 1 from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line 1 on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line 1, your health connection, originating from Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, Alaska. And I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today, we are following the evidence of a problem identified as cobalt poisoning, which has been associated with some hip implants, and especially the evidence of cognitive decline and neurologic problems with our guest orthopedist, Dr. Steve Tower, who's in the studio with me, and with Dr. Deborah Gideon, who is a neuropsychologist. She's also in the studio, and radiologist and nuclear medicine specialist, Dr. Bob Bridges, who was is on the telephone and was talking about the PET scan findings to date. What we've done so far is kind of discuss the origins of a problem that Dr. Tower had with his implant that led to some neurologic and cardiac problems associated with a high level of cobalt, which was known to be in his hip implant. After removal of that hip implant, symptoms went away, compatible with hip, cobalt poisoning natural history, and his cobalt levels went down. And he began to look at patients a little differently who had had hip implants and were having problems, and that has led us to where we are today, beginning to look a little bit locally, at least, at some scans and trying to document some of the evidence in a different way for neurologic problems with cobalt toxicity. Dr. Bridges, I'm going to come back to you just briefly. Anything else that I should ask you or you want listeners to hear about the findings to date before I move on to Dr. Gideon and the neuropsychology evaluations?
1,000 words, and I would encourage the listeners to hit the web and basically look at PET brain imaging, and mainly at what the patterns look like, the colorful images that you can get for Alzheimer's and frontal temporal dementia, and just get an idea of what those patterns look like, because the brain is basically projected as multiple colors depending on the severity of the lesions. And unlike clinical evaluation, where the subtleties to discern whether a patient has a disease or not is because of years of training and years of clinical experience to tease these things out of the background. Well, with the imaging, it's straightforward, and it doesn't require a lot of experience to evaluate these things, and so this becomes more readily evident. So it's an easier, quicker way with less requirement for understanding knowledge to see what's quantitatively going on with these patients. So the PET imaging is a shortcut to see what's going on at a global level in the brain that may be more evident earlier on than the subtle requirements of a very trained expert in neuroanalysis and neural assessment at the clinical level. So that's what my point right now is. The fact is that we have an interesting tool to augment what we require, a more sensitive examination by experts in neurology.
What we really don't have, and let me just play the devil's advocate for a second, you correct me if I'm wrong, is a good correlation between scans, PET scans, and blood cobalt levels. Is that fair to say?
We're still in the early phase.
Yep.
And so basically we have to begin to correlate the symptoms with the cobalt levels. Also, from what I understand from Dr. Tower, that the metal on metal versus metal on plastic have different levels of cobalt in the serum to toxicity levels, and Dr. Tower can talk about that. And so we have potential variance between how the metal gets into the body, whether what is it tagged to? Is it a ligand or is it organified? So Dr. Tower can talk about those toxicity levels, which may be more of a have to sort out with the PET scan.
Okay. Dr. Gideon, you've been very patient. So how did you get involved in all of this?
Well, as a neuropsychologist, our primary function is to study the human brain and to look at the relationship between the functioning of the brain and thinking abilities and emotion and behavior. And of course, what Dr. Tower has noted is that there are neurologic changes which include a number of cognitive changes or changes in thinking abilities and in mood and in the way a person functions on a day-to-day basis. The measures and the methods that neuropsychologists use are quantifiable. They are quantitative, very specific. We evaluate individuals, a variety of different thinking abilities, and compare their performance on a variety of different measures to what we would expect, what we do see in average individuals or in individuals who do not have brain pathology, who are of a given age, education. So in other words, we compare the individuals that we see to other people of the same age, education, sometimes it's gender that's relevant. And we determine if that person is statistically significantly different from what you would expect in one area or another of cognitive functioning or in mood. That tells us a lot about what areas of functioning are affected, but it also tells us what the brain is doing. We know that different parts of the brain and different systems of the brain are responsible for different kinds of thinking abilities. So by studying these specific thinking abilities, we can actually tell what parts of the brain are involved, much like a PET scan. Mm-hmm. What we also do in addition is describe the functioning of the person on a day-to-day basis. And So there is a partly clinical and partly it's very scientific in the sense that we use a lot of very specific data and quantifiable data, and so in looking at all of these people, we're taking into account the influence of age, influence of other factors. Now, on an individual basis, we also take into account factors that might be impacting their performance. So other factors like other kinds of disease processes that they might be experiencing. Let's say they're diabetic, for example. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But what our tests can do is very sensitive in the same way that PET scans can be very sensitive. It's just nice with the PET scan, it's a different technique and it's a very visually evident technique. It's nice to make that correspondence between the findings on the PET scan and the findings with the neuropsychological assessment, and that's really relevant to further supporting the findings, substantiating the findings scientifically with regard to the impact of cobalt toxicity on brain function. That's what we're attempting to do, is kind of coordinate our efforts here in evaluating people.
What are some of the specific findings that you have found, and are those compatible with metal poisoning, and are they specific enough to say they're different than other causes of cognitive decline, dementias, and so forth?
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, with regard to metal poisoning, we have found very, so far, I mean, this is very early right. in the process, but there are clear similarities. The findings that are common to a number of the patients that we've seen at this point are problems with fine motor coordination, problems with speed of information processing, problems with executive functioning. And so that encompasses a number of areas such as problem solving, planning, mental flexibility, working memory. And we also found problems with visual spatial processing, visual spatial memory and organization. In some cases, language memory was also affected. So a number of areas, those kinds of findings are common to studies with metal toxicity and looking at metal toxicity and effects on cognition. So many studies have found this relationship between toxic levels in the serum or in bone, the relationship between those and those levels and particular levels of cognitive dysfunction or deficits, and it usually is in these various areas.
Are you normally, in what you're doing, privy to PET scans in the sense that you could look at your results of your testing and say this is compatible with the PET scans, or no, we're talking two different languages here, you can't. I mean, so what I'm looking at is what's the correlation between the two, and how do we decide that whether there's a realistic correlation or not?
Oh, it's a wonderful question, but and it's also... as Dr. Bridges was saying, the PET has not been used clinically for very long. And practically speaking, it's uncommon in my experience to see a PET. This is really delightful to be able to see, have that opportunity to have that kind of information as well. With neuropsychological measures, we have part of the validity of the measures has been established via studies of the brain with lesions and with imaging. So we know, for example, that if you have a area of abnormality in one part of the brain, you are going to have most likely an impairment in a cognitive function that's associated with that particular area. And so we see that if you have a stroke in that area, we see that if there is an area of hypometabolism or maybe hypermetabolism on the PET scan or a lesion found on the MRI. So there is that correspondence. That's been established sort of over time kind of scientifically. Unfortunately, we don't often get the opportunity to have that correspondence directly on a clinical basis. It's certainly been more common in research. And when I have had an opportunity and the individual has the resources and I am working in a situation where I can say, look, we would like more substantiation or correspondence between my findings and the area of dysfunction, and it's really nice to be able to have the availability of those studies. And as Dr. Bridges was saying, the PET scan may show findings before the structural changes that are evident on the traditional MRI, And in the same way, the neuropsych testing can do that, but it's really nice when you can have that convergence and then relate it to the possible etiologies given the individual's history.
I think this is really, really fascinating. And what I'd like to do right now is, Steve, bring you back in two ways. One is to explain that all of us involved, all of you guys, I'm not involved today, that are involved in this are limited in the fact that most of this is happening in evaluating patient care things. This is not research. This is not, you have lots of money to go give everybody all the studies they need. You're picking and choosing patients that have significant problems and helping them with their medical issues, and you've collated the information to date. So there's some problems with that. And then also tell us about cobalt and what we know about cobalt toxicity. And does that fit with what we've found so far?
Yeah, as far as the first question, I think we're following a natural progression in how we learn things in medicine. And usually the first thing you see is a case report. This is something I haven't seen before. And it's kind of a starting point. It's the least potent information. And a lot of times a case report will come out and then suddenly there'll be a flurry of more case reports in the literature because people read the case report and say, oh, I've seen that too. And so this is clearly what happened when I published the first case reports of cobalt poisoning or cobaltism, as we named it, from joint replacements, that shortly after the report was published, we got reinforcing information of more publications all around the world. And that kind of says, this probably just was not a fluke. And then the next thing you see is a case series, a larger number of patients coming from one practice or from an institution. And again, this still isn't really research per se. These are patients with a problem that you've encountered in the course of your normal practice. And you're treating them as best you know how. You're not doing an experiment with different types of treatment. And you get a lot more information from the case series. And we have 9 patients now that are having the complaints that I would expect with early cobalt poisoning. They all have hip replacements that have chrome cobalt parts and pieces. But what needs to be realized is what's unique about these 9 patients is we also have the PET brain information. And 7 of the 9 have received the neurocognitive testing. I think before these patients, I've probably been exposed to about 30 patients that I believed had mild cobalt poisoning, but I didn't have this degree of information about them. We weren't aware that the PET brain might be a helpful tool to diagnose the problem. And neurocognitive testing is a very valuable tool as far as bringing everything together. And probably ties more closely with the problems the patient may be experiencing in day-to-day life. But unfortunately, it's devilishly difficult to get insurers to pay for it. Mm-hmm. Very fortunate that Dr. Gideon was willing to do this for our patients because it was really kind of a labor of love for her. But right now, I would say we're developing a very detailed case series that are utilizing other diagnostic tools beyond just what the patient is telling me in the clinic.
All right. Quickly, what about cobalt poisoning? How does that work? Where's the cobalt coming from? Why is it going up?
Cobalt poisoning is a fascinating history. About more than 50 years ago, cobalt was used to treat anemia, predominantly in children who had kidney problems. And the first reports of cobalt poisoning in humans were actually in infants that were presenting with thyroid failure and in heart failure. And then later, despite that experience in children, they also used it to treat anemia in adults with renal failure. And there you're dealing with patients that could actually talk to you. And those patients experienced ringing in the ears and deafness that was well documented. Another means of cobalt exposure is in industry. And there's some patients where hygiene was poor in the workplace and they got a very large dose of cobalt. and they tended to present with deafness and blindness, and in several instances, severe heart failure. So these are kind of the extreme manifestations. There was an occupational literature of just general surveillance of patients involved in industries where there was cobalt exposure. This included Dutch women who painted the blue pottery, because cobalt is commonly used in blue dye, and Scandinavian men involved in processing cobalt and making machine metals. And they showed some subtle tendencies toward thyroid problems and some subtle tendencies towards cardiac problems. But as far as this relatively subtle presentation that we appear to be noting, where the patients are just kind of saying, well, you know, doc, I think I'm a French fry short of a Happy Meal, and it's, you know, goes beyond what I would expect with normal aging, or my family has noted that I'm becoming more moody or irritable, forgetful, difficulty with planning. That's what these patients were complaining of, which stimulated me to, one, not only check their cobalt level, but to do the PET scan and to get the neurocognitive testing. And that particular part of the cobalt toxicity is only now getting realized, I think, with what I call arthroprosthetic cobalt poisoning or arthroprosthetic cobaltism. And I think we're going to see that there'll be many, many more cases related to joint replacement than have been described in the literature from other causes. One, a lot of people are exposed in industry, but there's fairly strict standards of industrial hygiene that keeps people from getting very high levels. So I think if you look at the at-risk population of people who are being exposed to levels of cobalt beyond what is allowed in industry, it's the joint replacement population. And I estimate that there's probably 4 to 5 million Americans at risk for elevated cobalt levels because of joint replacement.
Hip replacements in particular? Are you also talking about knees? And then an email has come in not only about knees, people have been asking, well, what about shoulders?
So far, the problem has only been identified in patients with hips. And every case I've seen, the patient has had a hip. We're getting a little bit of a thread that if you have a hip and two knees and a shoulder, that may elevate your risk. But it's the hips that seem to have the forces across the joint that would accelerate the wear of the joint surfaces and would accelerate the forces necessary to cause corrosion at the modular junctions. But that said, I would also say that it's really been the hip patients that have been the most extensively studied, because what really opened our eyes to this problem was the metal-on-metal hip replacement. And there really aren't similar technology has not been used in the knees, which are chrome cobalt on plastic, or the shoulders, which tend to be chrome cobalt on plastic. So I think definitely the hip is the joint that we should focus on. And I wouldn't, patients that do not have an artificial hip but have other artificial joints, I don't think they need to be concerned about this problem at this time. I think it's unlikely to be a problem to them.
The other thing that we've mentioned, Dr. Bridges has mentioned, you've mentioned, and I can't remember if Deborah mentioned as well, is that this is a potentially reversible problem. It was reversible in your case, so it behooves us, it would seem to me, to be really aware that if a patient is having symptoms, that can be treated. Unfortunately, it may mean getting rid of the implant, though.
And this is an area where I've been very cautious about to date, and I think this is where both the neurocognitive testing and the PET brain scans are going to be very helpful, is to determine what is reasonable treatment for patients that have elevated cobalt levels. Revision surgery is a big deal. It's significant surgery. Sometimes these joints aren't easy to get out. So not only do you have to get the old one out, but then you need to replace it with something that doesn't contain cobalt.
So really what you're saying is if you've got somebody's got what they think are symptoms, you think are symptoms, we need some other objective evidence that there's problems going on. And Dr. Bridges is saying that this PET scan allows us to somewhat quantify even before clinical symptoms. And so you got more evidence that we need to be doing something is what I hear you say.
Yeah, correct. And although we're dealing with a limited number of patients, nine patients to date, that's three times the number that Dr. Owalu needed to define traumatic encephalopathy, traumatic concussive encephalopathy in NFL players. So, you know, compared to that, we've got a lot of patients. And we are seeing a pattern where the severity of involvement in the PET seems to correlate with how severely the patients are affected. So I think this is going to be very helpful, particularly if the patient's primary problem is the neurologic issues and they don't have a problem at the joint. If a patient has these pseudotumor reactions around the hip, then I don't have to go through this drill as far as deciding whether or not to revise the hip. The hip needs to be redone just because of problems at the hip, where both the neurocognitive testing and the PET brain imaging is going to be very helpful is for the patients that appear to have neurologic issues, but they don't have problems at the hip.
Bob, you're still with us?
Yes, I am.
Let me ask you and Deborah a question that comes to my mind just because I have a background in epidemiology and because this is not really research. One of the problems could be that you all are biased. You already know that the patient you're seeing has, you potentially already know the patient is already has a high cobalt level or not. Do you, were the scans you looked at, did you know that? And Deborah, did you know ahead of time that there may have been cobalt problems in the patients you were seeing?
I knew that they were elevated. And patients, we were only doing patients that had a clinical presentation and the elevated levels. At this point in the game, it would be unconscionable to scan what we consider to be normal people at this time. So basically, these people had a defined disease state that we were looking at. And then from there, later on, research could then be tilted toward people who have not become symptomatic yet. But right now, because the justification is only for patients who have a recognizable disease process.
Right.
Yes.
Makes sense.
And Dr. Woodard, you had said earlier that this is the clinical, you know, we're clinical study right now. It's not a research study. So yes, we want to be comparing these people to people that have no cobalt elevation in their blood. we want to do a sound scientific study, but yes, we were evaluating them clinically for the consequences of the cobalt, and we did know, yes.
The images, I was listening to Dr. Gideon, and she was talking about the visual problems, and I was bringing the patients, and some of them have significant loss in the visual cortex. We're seeing significant drop in metabolic activity in the temporal lobes, where there's memory. We're seeing significant loss in the basal ganglia, where you have fine motor skills like Parkinson's disease process, and sensory motor. So as she was discussing the different symptoms that she's been finding these people, it's been paralleling what we've been seeing, at least on these mapping of the brain on the PET imaging.
And also the parietal and frontal components of the images, the abnormalities, the hypometabolism there, and the executive function, and some of the visual spatial functions tie in with that as well. So there is definitely, at least in a preliminary sense, a correspondence between the two.
I would like to see, and Dr. Bridges can correct me if I'm wrong, certainly the PET brains, and I think you have to understand formal neurocognitive testing is very well controlled, as is the PET brain, as far as you have a normative population to compare to. And you also have factors in the testing that tells you whether or not the testing is reliable based on the patient. And the other thing, you know, I think in all fairness about the PET brains, even though Dr. Bridges was aware these patients had elevated cobalt levels, there's not a way for him, and these images are so visual, and one of the programs he's using just gives numeric data that I don't think he could fudge that based on predating knowledge, but he might confirm that.
The study is easy to perform technically. The imaging is crunched with computers, and there's no way for me to fudge anything. The colors are set by the programs and the statistical evaluation, which on a huge basis of normal atlas of normals around the world, is a printout. I have no way to fudge anything on this one. So it was, you know, straightforward information coming out, and this is why it's easy to interpret, because it's just there.
All right, we're in our last 2 minutes. This discussion is so fascinating to me, I could go on for at least another hour, I can think of. But I want to, there's a lot of listeners. I have failed to mention again, because I wanted to let the conversation go, that we did not take phone calls. We are more than happy to take emails at line1@alaskapublic.org, and we will. I've answered some of those questions already. Those that are not, we'll get to Dr. Tower so you can answer them. People that are listening have questions about their specific situation, I know. But I'd like to let Dr. Tower kind of sum up. Where is this going? What's next? What's the logical next steps for you to be taking here?
I think similar to where I was in 2010, the priority now is to take this case series and publish it, get it out in the world, and see if we get kind of the same confirmation that we did with initial case reports that other centers are seeing this. And I think that's critical, because I believe that there's tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of individuals probably experiencing these relatively mild cognitive issues, where it potentially could turn into a very large issue for the patient and is potentially reversible. So I think it's critical that medical providers are aware that this problem exists. And then beyond that, the next thing to do is try to figure out how we can turn this into formal research. And that's going to require some careful planning and some funding.
It's easy to understand, because of the confounding variables in the age group of this population, where this could be going on, especially in milder forms that are clearly reversible but unrecognized. I think that's important. This is one of the things I would say.
You talk to primary providers, and you know the problems we're talking about, their waiting rooms are full of these problems.
Right.
And it's easy for both practitioners and the patients and the families to dismiss this to normal aging.
But at the same time, we don't want to have people over-worried. It still needs some evidence to be gathered. Thanks very much. This has been stimulating, a wonderful, wonderful conversation. My guests today were our orthopedist, Dr. Steve Tower, clinical neuropsychologist, Dr. Deborah Gideon, and nuclear medicine specialist, Dr. Bob Bridges. If you want to continue this discussion on hip implants and cobalt poisoning, you can join KSKA on Facebook at www.alaskapublic.org. And you can also find our archives and have people listen in the future to this, or tonight or later, at this particular program. Next week we'll return. We're going to be talking about pediatric sleep issues with sleep specialist Dr. Ross Dodge. Pat Yak is chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron, audio engineer, today's program. This is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.